For joining us this afternoon. The topic for this breakout session is strengthening state laws to protect victims and to combat trafficking. And Brad Miles is joining us from the Polaris Center, and he has extensive experience in helping with the federal laws that have been drafted around trafficking and also the state laws on this issue. He's been working on combating trafficking issues since 2002. He currently serves as the executive director and CEO of the Polaris Project. I joined him recently for a presentation on the National Trafficking Hotline, and I thought that was really fascinating to learn all the ways in which Polaris is gathering information and helping those across the U.S. Have access to resources that they wouldn't have to individually collect for themselves. Also with the Polaris Project, Brad trains and provides consultancy services and technical assistance to interdisciplinary agencies such as the federal government and the U.S. Congress. One of the things that struck me as being very important is that he's a key advocate in bridging the communication between all these national organizations. Many of the organizations that I've met here today, the nonprofits have come to interact with each other and to learn what their resources are. And I think it's very valuable to have one-stop shopping where you can come and train yourself up. So I would like for you to ask to join me in making Brad Miles welcome to the Freedom Summit.
Okay, well, welcome to the session on state policy. I'm glad that you all are here. You can hear me okay? Everything's okay? Okay, great. So I'm going to do a couple things. One, I was hoping to touch a little bit on federal policy in the morning session between me and John Vanek, but we didn't get a chance to get into it. So I'm going to divert for a few minutes and talk briefly about some of the main federal policies that are happening. Then what I'm going to try to do is walk you through some of the pressing issues in the field focused on state policy and what role you could play, and try to direct you to some resources that exist out there on state policy. And then I'm going to be mindful of time. We have until 2:45, so we have about an hour and 10 minutes together. And I'm going to try to leave plenty of time for questions. Because I know that we had the index cards, we didn't get to as many of the questions, so I want to leave plenty of time for questions. But one of the interesting things with this presentation is previously you kind of heard me talking a lot about the hotline and Polaris as the hotline, and that's a whole part of Polaris, sure, but now we're kind of flipping the switch and turning our brains off of the national hotline and totally moving into the Polaris policy side, which is a whole other department of Polaris, a whole other expertise of Polaris. And I think that when folks get really associated with, oh, Polaris, they do the national hotline, it kind of doesn't realize all the other things that we do, because Polaris has five major departments and the hotline is only one of the five. So this is pause your brain on the hotline and let's talk about policy. So let me open a little bit with just an overview of what's going on with federal policy so that you all have a sense of what is the landscape that's about to be encountered when we start this new Congress, and what are some of the bills that they're planning on taking up. And I'd be happy to take your questions on those federal bills, and then we'll dive into the state policy side. So federal bills. There are five major federal bills that are in the works with Congress right now. So as the new Congress is convening with the new Republican-controlled House, there are going to be four or five major bills that this Congress is going to be taking up and working on. And some of them are new bills that haven't been worked on before. Some of them are carryover bills that died in the last session of Congress and need to be reintroduced. So I'm going to walk through what some of those bills are. The first bill has to do with child sex trafficking here in the United States. And some people, the term that they use for that is the commercial sexual exploitation of children, CSEC, or CSEC is the acronym, which is children being commercially sexually exploited. Other people use a term for that called child sex trafficking. Other people use the term domestic minor sex trafficking, or DMST. So there's all these terms, but basically what they all mean is children in the sex trade. And by children, they mean 17 or younger, because the federal age differentiating child and adult is 18. So we're talking about children 17 or younger who are engaging in some sort of commercial sex act, which is a sex act that is commercial in nature. Commercial in nature means you're engaging in the sex act because there's some sort of something of value that you're exchanging. You're not just engaging in the sex act because you care about the person. There's something of value being exchanged, whether or not that's goods or services or money or a necklace or cell phone minutes or drugs or whatever else. If you could assign a value to something and you're saying this sex act is occurring to get that thing of value, that makes it a commercial sex act. And so the question is then, how many kids, 17 or younger, are engaging in sex acts that could be determined as commercial? And how are those sex acts exploiting them in a certain way? So this first bill focuses on that population, children who are engaging in commercial sex acts. And it was very active in the last session of Congress. The senators on the Senate side who introduced the bill are Senator Wyden from Oregon and Senator Cornyn from Texas. And so it was a Democrat-Republican pairing there. And then on the House side, it was introduced by Congresswoman Maloney from New York. And so there's a Senate side and a House side, and they both have to pass the same exact version of the bill in order for the bill to then go to the president's desk. So this bill, what it's going to do is it creates these grant programs at the amount of about $2.5 million per program, and there'll be six of them. And these grant programs will go to these six communities in the United States, and when the community gets the funds, they can then use those funds to crack down on child sex trafficking in their town. So let's say Charmaine Bach and Alameda County gets one of those grants. They'll now have $2.5 million of dollars infused into the city to focus on building a comprehensive response for kids who are in the sex trade. So maybe they'll use some of those funds to pay nonprofit workers. Maybe they'll use some of those funds to pay for a shelter. Maybe they'll use some of those funds to pay for law enforcement training. Maybe they'll use some of those funds to hire new law enforcement officers. It's basically the protection side of the victims as well as the prosecution side for the traffickers, as well as the prevention side. Maybe they'll use some of those funds to speak to high schools about, you know, look out if you're getting recruited by a pimp sort of thing. So that's this bill, domestic minor sex trafficking bill. And I'll take your question in a little while. Let me get through everything. And it came really close to finishing last Congress. There was a version of the bill that passed the Senate and a version of the bill that passed the House, but the two versions were like 2% different. And like there were these two little provisions that the Senate wanted in and the House wanted out, and they couldn't agree on it. And they kept going back and forth, and the Senate said, put it in, and the House said, take it out, and they couldn't agree, and ultimately they weren't willing to pass the same bill, and Congress adjourned and they went home for Christmas. And so the bill died, ran out of time, but it came very close, and so that bill is going to get launched again this year. That'll be the first major federal bill that happens. Hopefully it'll go through this year. Hopefully the Senate and the House will work out their big discussion, and it'll pass. President Obama will sign it, and then there'll be these dollars that go out to these communities. So some people call that the Wyden bill because Senator Wyden from Oregon is really passionate about pushing that bill after he saw this documentary called Playground, which is another good documentary. If you're looking for more movies to watch on trafficking, Call and Response is a great one. Playground is another one. So there's the Wyden bill. Another bill, federal bill, that's looking to move forward this year is called the Child Protection Compact Act, or the CPCA. And the CPCA also focuses on child sex trafficking, but it focuses on child sex trafficking in other countries around the world by focusing on two or three pilot countries where we're really going to fund a country to take a comprehensive approach to cracking down on child sex trafficking in that country. So pick a country like Cambodia. What sort of resources would be needed to give that country a whole infusion of resources to say, let's really try to rid the sex trade of all children in Cambodia, and let's prove that it can be done in one country. And if it can be done in one country, then we could replicate it in all these other countries, but it's starting with a pilot. And so it's kind of interesting that the Wyden bill is basically child sex trafficking focused in the U.S., and the Child Protection Compact Act is child sex trafficking focused internationally, but they're both very similar. And so the same constituency that fights for one might as well fight for the other, because they're kind of the same thing. So that was another bill, lots of advocacy around that bill last year. Lots of different faith-based advocacy specifically around those bills. IJM was very active, World Vision was very active, but ultimately the bills wound up not getting through. And so that'll be reintroduced this year, we're likely. Third bill that I'll focus on is very important for this coming year is the main federal legislation on human trafficking, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. The Trafficking Victims Protection Act, you've heard it mentioned multiple times. You heard Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice talk about it. You heard John Vanek talk about it. The Trafficking Victims Protection Act is kind of like the main seminal document that launched a lot of the human trafficking work in the United States. It was passed in the year 2000, signed into law by President Clinton on October 28th, and it really put in place the framework for the government to begin responding to the issue of trafficking. So it launched a new office within the Department of Health and Human Services to be the trafficking office. It launched a new office within the Department of State to be the trafficking office. That whole report that Secretary of State Rice talked about, the TIP report that rates all the countries around the world, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act created that report. The Trafficking Victims Protection Act also created the paradigm that the United States uses to fight trafficking, which is the 3P paradigm of prevention, protection, and prosecution. Some are saying there needs to be a fourth P, which is the P of partnership. So you have this Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which has really been resourcing the field, because the A, or the idea of these laws is to authorize federal dollars. And there's a difference on one side of the house of authorizing dollars, and the other side of the house appropriates dollars. And there's a subtle difference. And I was in Washington for a long time and didn't even realize the difference. It's like they're both two words. They both start with A. They both have like 13 letters to it, and you kind of use them interchangeably. But they actually mean totally different things. So in the authorizing side of the house, all the authorizing side of the house does is create the possibility of dollars. So they might say, we think that abstinence-only education is important. So we hereby authorize $100 million a year for abstinence education, and the money is authorized. And then on the appropriation side of the house, they're like, okay, we've been authorized up to $100 million to spend, but you know what? We're just not gonna do it. We don't feel like it. Like, we don't agree with abstinence-only education, or we don't have enough money to spend because we're fighting this war in Afghanistan or whatever else. So even though there's 100 million authorized, we're going to leave it at zero. Or they might say, 100 million, good, that's a nice high cap. We're only going to give 5 million. So the appropriation side of the house has a lot of flexibility over what to do and what not to do. And so the authorizing side of the house is the first step because it creates the possibility of something, but then the appropriation side of the house has to make that the reality. So the Trafficking Victims Protection Act authorized all of these dollars. It authorized dollars for grant programs. It authorized dollars for law enforcement. It authorized dollars to pay other countries to fight trafficking, all this stuff. And then now we're waiting on the appropriation side to see how many of those dollars actually get created in reality. And the sad thing is that sometimes the appropriation side funds the entire thing to the whole 100% level of the authorization. Sometimes they come in lower, sometimes they leave something at zero. And so we as a field need to do much better advocacy on the appropriation side of the house, not just on the authorizing side of the house. But that Trafficking Victims Protection Act, it has only authorized dollars to be spent up until September 30th of this year. So we got the time, the clock is ticking, and we've got 9 months left. And when those 9 months run out, we need a new authorizing bill to create more dollars to fight trafficking in the U.S., or the government money to fight trafficking totally dries up. So big, 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 big important bill that needs to happen this year and needs to go through is what's going to be called the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act of 2011. Now, the way the authorization works is they usually give you an authorization for little couple-year periods because they don't want to authorize dollars for the next 20 years, because what if 10 years from now you don't really need that much money to fight trafficking and all these people are getting the money still? So they only give you money in two-year increments. So the first TVPA authorized dollars for 01 and 02, then the money ran out. So we had a new TVPA that passed in 2003, authorized dollars for 2 years, 03 and 04. Then we needed one in 05, authorized money for 3 years. They were like, we'll give you a little more this time. So then that went for 05, 06, 07. Then we had to have a TVPA of 2008, and that gave us money for 08, 09, 010, and 011, and it's about to run out. So now we need this new TVPA of 2011. So look for a big push where people are going to be calling out their networks and saying, call your congressman, call your senator, call your elected representative. We need people to fight for the TVPA because money's about to run out. And so that's going to be happening this year as well, in addition to the CPCA bill and the Wyden bill. And then the last bill that I'll highlight for you all that I think is important to keep in mind is this bill that's focused on the idea of supply chains. And you heard a lot this morning about supply chains. And if you've been to Justin Dillon and Nathan's workshop, they talked a lot about supply chains as well. But it's the idea of there might be slavery in the products we buy. There might be slavery in your Hanes t-shirt. There might be slavery in your shoes or whatever else, right? And so how do we rid ourselves of slavery in the supply chain? So some people say, let's just pass a bill that says any corporation that's found to have slavery in their supply chain can be thrown in jail. And it's just like pretty simple. Like, you know, if we go to Abercrombie and Fitch and we find slavery in their supply chain, all the Abercrombie executives are going straight to jail because they committed a criminal crime. So there are some people that are saying that, right? And there are other people that are saying, well, you know, are they really criminally liable? Should they go to jail? Would they fight against that bill? Yes, they would. They'd be like, don't make us go to jail. It wasn't our fault. We didn't have the slavery. Someone else did. And so there's a whole discussion around that, right? And so people are saying, how do we hold corporations accountable at the right place that they should be held accountable? So in California, there was this bill that got introduced that was the idea of beginning to take a look at this idea of corporations and their supply chains. And the first version of the bill that got kind of conceptualized and talked about had much more teeth to it. It was like, if we find slavery in your supply chain, there's going to be fines, there's going to be all this sort of stuff. Because there's all these fines for stuff like child pornography. Like, if you find child pornography on an internet service provider like Google or Yahoo or whatever else, they could be fined $50,000 a day for every day that that child pornography is still on their site without taking it down. So maybe there'd be something like that. Like, if we find slavery in your supply chain, we'll charge your corporation $50,000 a day until you get it out. So those types of bills. The corporations were obviously fighting against those bills and saying, don't do that. So ultimately, what came down was a bill that is kind of seems like a simple little idea, but I think it has more impact to it than people realize. And what the bill says is, every corporation doing business in California, so they don't necessarily have to be based in California, they just have to be doing business in California. So that's the first requirement. Any corporation doing business in California. Second requirement is who makes yearly revenue of more than $100 million or more. So it's the big ones, like Walmart and IKEA and others. It's not catching like the small ice cream shop or whatever else, right? So it's any corporation doing business in California with annual revenues of $100 million or more. A year from now, has to make public their internal policy for what sort of internal checks they do to make sure that they don't have any slavery in their supply chain. So they basically have to produce a document. It's like a 3-page document or something that just says, IKEA takes the following steps to make sure that none of our cheap furniture is made with slavery. We send a trip of our company executives to China once a year, and we investigate our factories, or we conduct compliance checks, or we monitor all of our subcontracts with the following things. They just have to put this stuff down on paper, and then they have to make that policy public, either on their website or by sending it into the California state government. So there isn't any teeth to whether or not they actually implement that policy or not. There's no monitoring mechanism. But it's just saying, whatever your internal policy is, put it up on your website and make it public. Now, on the one hand, it seems like that provision has no teeth to it. And everyone's like, who cares about a policy, right? But there could be more to it than that, because it empowers consumers to then begin reading all these different policies. So say you're going to go buy a new pair of tennis shoes, and you're sitting there and you're looking at a Nike shoe and a Reebok shoe and a New Balance shoe. You can go download all their policies on slavery and be like, wow, the Nike policy is this thin little one-page document, but the New Balance policy is this 14-page, really thorough document with all this stuff. I think I'm going to buy New Balance shoes. So it enables consumers to make decisions, kind of like what David was talking about earlier with the scanning the barcode, right? So all these companies now have the next year to formulate these policies, and then in early 2011, they have to make those policies public. So that bill passed in California, passed both houses, and then there's a big question of, is Governor Schwarzenegger going to sign it or not? And people were saying, well, he's definitely going to sign it. Other people were saying, no, he's pro-business, he's not going to sign it. And then at the end of the day, he decided to sign it. And the Chamber of Commerce said that this bill is a job killer. And he said, it's not a job killer, it's a lifesaver. And he signed the bill. So California became the first state in the country to pass this supply chains bill. Now, pretty good, right? It was pretty cool. So now there is interest at the federal level to take that California bill, and anytime it says California, swap it out with the United States and pass it federally. So it's any business doing business anywhere in the United States with profits of $100 million or more anywhere in the United States has to make this policy public by 2012, and we'll see if that passes, and we'll see if there's actually interest to write that bill and to pass it. So those are the four federal bills I wanted to let you all know about that you should keep in your minds on the horizon for the next 12, 18 months or so. Is the Wyden bill, the CPCA, the Trafficking Act reauthorization or else the money runs out, and the Federal Supply Chains Transparency Act. So four key bills to keep in mind, right? Okay. So now let's move and talk about state policy, which is what you are all here to talk about. So that was a huge tangent to give you a little bit more information about federal stuff. So at the state level, just because we have these federal bills on trafficking, like the TVPA, they create the law of the land federally. But in the United States, we have what's known as a federalist system, where we have a federal government and 50 state governments. And so the state governments are kind of doing their own thing as well. So there needs to be state legislative action on the issue of human trafficking so that the federal bill, yes, it exists, but there's also state bills. So in 2002, there was barely any state bills on human trafficking. Barely any. Just wasn't on the radar of state legislatures. And then the TVPA passed, and then state legislatures started saying, well, is human trafficking even a crime in our state? Like, yeah, it's a federal crime, but is it a crime in our state? And most people started realizing it's not even a crime to commit human trafficking in the state, right? It's a crime to do something like human trafficking, like it's a crime to beat somebody up, and sometimes traffickers beat somebody up, so it's like you can prosecute them for physical assault. It's a crime to kidnap somebody. It's a crime to pimp somebody. So there's all these crimes that are kind of like chipping away at trafficking, but weren't actually calling it trafficking. And so what prosecutors were having to do is they were having to prosecute traffickers using these other crimes. Like, okay, here's this guy forcing four women into a brothel in an Asian massage parlor. Let's prosecute him for kidnapping. And so it kind of gave this weird impression where it didn't really give you a crystal clear impression of who's committing trafficking and who's committing kidnapping. It was all getting blended together. So all these state legislatures started saying, well, let's make human trafficking a crime in our state, and let's introduce a bill. So the first state to do that was Washington State, and they introduced a bill in 2002, and it passed, and it made human trafficking a crime in Washington State. And those of us who were working on the issue back then were kind of like, okay, cool, the state legislators are starting to do more. And then over the past 6 or 7 years, you've seen tons of state legislators wake up and want to do something on the issue of trafficking. And one of the main things they want to do is to make human trafficking a crime in their state. And so now, fast forward 7 or 8 years, we have 44 of the 50 states that have introduced and passed some sort of trafficking legislation in their state legislature. So in 2002, we went from 1, and in 2010, we went to 44. So imagine, you know, 100 years from now, kids are sitting in high school reading a history textbook about the, you know, proliferation of human trafficking law. And they'll realize that it all really happened in this 8-year period between 2002 and 2010. And the state legislators just passed this entire thing. I have this colleague at Polaris that used to work on the issue of dogfighting and cockfighting. And she was just really disgusted at the idea of people fighting dogs and fighting roosters and all that stuff. And so the Humane Society of the United States and others basically said, this is appalling that dogfighting and cockfighting isn't even a crime in all of these 50 states, and it's this brutal practice. So they set out and they had a 50-state plan where they wanted to make dogfighting and cockfighting illegal in all 50 states. And it wasn't that mentally hard to do. They just put a big blank map on the wall and said, we're gonna go state by state until each one passes. And when the state passes, we're gonna check it off until we have all 50 states done. And then we'll say, we passed these laws in all 50 states, right? And they went and did that. Now that's what's happening with these human trafficking laws, is we're just waiting for each state to kind of pass its own law until we get to all 50. And so Polaris is one of the groups at the state level who's been going state by state and methodically tracking who's doing what and where are we in terms of these state human trafficking laws. So there's been this birth of interest at the state level for state legislatures like the General Assembly and the state senates and whatever else to start introducing bills. And the reason that folks are doing that, one, is because their conscience says we need to have a bill on this, but two, they're elected representatives and they're saying there's really starting to be a political benefit to caring about trafficking, because there's all these people, there's 1,700 people who show up for a conference on trafficking. So if I become the legislator that's like charging forward to care about trafficking and I'm the new William Wilberforce, all these people are going to want to elect me. And I'm going to beat my opponent because I'm going to say, this guy over here doesn't do anything about human trafficking. Look at me, I've passed 5 trafficking bills, and all these people are going to vote for me, not this other person. And so people are realizing that trafficking is actually a benefit to their political future. So it's kind of this fighting trafficking. So it's this interesting thing that's beginning to happen as there's a new constituency built up around this issue, right? So there's so many things that state legislatures can do to fight trafficking. And we're seeing a level of interest at the state legislative level like we've never seen before in the past 8 years. The state legislatures are hopping with discussions about trafficking and, you know, what's another bill we can do and what's a new innovative bill we can do and give me another idea, I'll introduce it. Already this year, in the first couple weeks of this year, we've already been working on 30 state bills that have been introduced in the past 3 weeks, basically, from different states around the country working on trafficking. And so you're seeing this thing. There's also this whole national coalition called the National Conference of State Legislatures, NCSL. And NCSL has this annual meeting when all these elected representatives come together at one place and they talk about different state bills they're interested in. And just last year, NCSL voted to make human trafficking a top legislative priority for 2011. So that's a signal that the state legislatures are taking this really seriously, right? There's another thing called the Uniform Code Commission that tries to make sure all the state laws kind of look the same as each other, so we don't have all these different definitions of things. And the Uniform Code Commission is starting to work on the issue of human trafficking in 2011. So at the state level, there's all these exciting, exciting, exciting things that are happening. So Polaris created this tool on our website. If you go to polarisproject.org, we have this map, under the policy section of the website, and the map shows you at any given time all of the state bills that are happening on human trafficking in all 50 states. So you can click on your state, and it'll give you this little thing, and it'll say, here's the three bills that have been introduced in your state, and you can track them, and you could vote for them, and you could do stuff, and you could, you know, call your congressman about them. So it's this tool that kind of tracks everything. So one of the things that we do in a totally different program than the hotline is we function as this central hub of state policy work. And the reason that we believe in doing this is policy and passing new policy, when you're building a body of law, is one of the most long-term systemic things that you can do to fight trafficking, because it puts something in place that's going to be in place 100 years from now. And it's much, much more sticky than attending a conference or calling the hotline or any quick thing that you can do, you know, reporting a tip about a case. All that stuff, it happens and then it disappears. But policy, once it's passed, it's locked into place for a long time until someone tries to revise or repeal that law. And so if we're really trying to work on trafficking at the long, long term, one of the things to do is to take this moment in time when trafficking is incredibly hot in the public dialogue and conferences are happening and new things are happening and there's this emerging human rights issue that's kind of breaking into the mainstream, this is the time to put in place that legislative body of law. So it's almost like we're constructing a house and we're building the framework of the house with the wood and the, you know, the sheet metal and whatever else. This is the time that we're actually building that house in these past 8 years. So what this map does is we picked 10 different types of state laws that states tend to pass. So I could walk you through these 10 state laws, right? One, number one, says a basic sex trafficking provision, which says if you put minors in the sex trade, you're committing trafficking, or if you put adults in the sex trade and use force, fraud, or coercion to put them there, you're committing trafficking. So do you have a basic sex trafficking provision at your state level? Second law talks about labor trafficking. Do you have a basic labor trafficking provision which says if you force anyone to work against their will, whether or not they're an adult or a child, and you use force, fraud, or coercion, you're committing labor trafficking. Have you made that a crime at your state level? Another thing it talks about is asset forfeiture. So if a trafficker is committing trafficking and then they make all this money, and they buy all this stuff with that money. They buy a nice house, they buy a nice BMW, they buy fancy cars and jewelry, and then you catch that trafficker, does law enforcement have the power to seize all of their assets and say, that stuff was made with this illicit behavior, it was made off the backs of slaves, we're taking it from you, and we're gonna use that and make money for law enforcement or whatever else, right? So can we do asset forfeiture? So there's a question, has your state passed that bill? A fourth thing talks about training on human trafficking. There are some states that are passing a bill that says, we shall now create a new training program for some audience in our state, and it's now required of you to get trained on human trafficking. So to be a police officer in California, you can't be a police officer until you've proven you've been trained on human trafficking. So states are passing these training bills. Fifth one talks about the creation of a human trafficking commission or statewide task force. So sometimes a state will pass a bill that says, upon the passage of this bill, there hereby is created a statewide task force called the California Statewide Task Force that will study trafficking at a statewide level and will come up with statewide national responses and will come up with a response protocol. Have you passed one of those statewide task force bills? Number six talks about posting the national hotline. There have been some interesting states around the country that have passed a bill that says, we're gonna post the hotline at all the truck stops, or we're gonna post the hotline at all the rest stops on the highway, or we're gonna post the hotline at, Texas passed a bill that said, anybody who has an alcohol and beverage license in Texas to sell alcohol, as a condition of keeping their alcohol and beverage license, they have to post the human trafficking hotline. So now all these bars and clubs in Texas have the human trafficking hotline somewhere. And so people are doing those types of bills. Seven talks about the Safe Harbor Bill. Now this is a really interesting bill because it talks about minors in the commercial sex trade. And minors in the commercial sex trade are, when you view them through the eyes of the law, there's actually a total conflict that's happening within the law. So on one part of the law, we have statutory rape laws that say if you have sex with someone under the age of 18, you're committing statutory rape. And the reason we're saying that is the government believes that 18 is the age that you're able to begin making adult decisions for yourself. And anything before that, your brain hasn't developed enough, your morals haven't developed enough, your emotional maturity hasn't developed enough. So we're saying a 13-year-old doesn't really have the ability to vote or drive or have sex or all these different things. So if you're having sex with one of those people, they can't consent to it because they haven't grown up enough to be able to know what consent means. So you're committing rape, right? So anytime a child is engaging in sex, they can't consent to it. Yet in a whole other part of the law, we're saying if you catch a child in the sex trade, like a 13-year-old quote-unquote child prostitute who's having sex for money, you can take them and throw them in jail and charge them with the crime of being a prostitute. So how are we saying on the one side of the law, you can't consent to sex, and on the other side of the law, we're saying we can throw you in jail for having sex. So it's like we can throw you in jail for something that we don't think you can consent to. So that's kind of a legal conflict, right? And then there's the question of, are kids in the sex trade, are they criminals who need to be taught a lesson? They're just like slutty kids or whatever else? Or are they victims that have been exploited by adults and need to be treated as victims, right? And there are some people who have these really pejorative attitudes, and that's why I said that, to kind of push some people's buttons. There are some people who are like, yeah, that 13-year-old, they need to be taught a lesson. You know, she's loose, she's fast, she's slutty, you know, it's her choice. She made some bad decisions, she needs to be thrown in jail. Give her some time to think about it. And there are other people who are like, really? She's 13, you know, like she's been victimized, she's probably been sexually abused as a child, all these different things. So folks are beginning to look at that and saying, well, which is it? Are they victims or are they criminals? Can they consent or can they not? And so New York State passed a law called the Safe Harbor Bill that says, we're going to iron all this out. And we're going to view kids in the sex trade as victims. And we're going to view kids in the sex trade as not being able to convict them as a child prostitute. So if you find a kid in the sex trade, it's the equivalent of finding a commercial sexual abuse victim. They need to be taken for services and mental health therapy and shelter and all these things, not put in handcuffs. And New York passed that bill. And then three other states followed suit: Washington State, Connecticut, and Illinois. So now you have, out of the 50 states, you have four of them that have this safe harbor bill in place and 46 left that don't, even though one county in California also has it. And so how do we think about that? And how do we want to look at that? So this number 7 takes a look at that, right? Number 8 talks about you don't have to prove force, fraud, or coercion. Now here's an absurdity, right? In the federal definition of trafficking, the trafficking definition boils down basically to these three buckets: kids in the sex trade, adults in the sex trade who are there by force, fraud, or coercion, anyone forced to work by force, fraud, or coercion. That's really trafficking. Forget about the movement. Forget about border crossing, whatever else. Trafficking is those three things: kids in the sex trade, adults in the sex trade by force, fraud, or coercion, anyone forced to work against their will by force, fraud, or coercion. That's the definition, right? And notice, when you're talking about kids in the sex trade, you don't have to prove force, fraud, or coercion, for the same reason that the statutory rape laws exist, which is they can't consent. So why should you have to prove that they were forced if they can't consent in the first place? But there are some laws that actually said to prove child trafficking, you have to prove that they were forced or coerced into the sex trade. And that's put into the law. So they actually made it harder to find child sex trafficking than it should have been. And so there are some states that did that, so we're giving states credit for those that didn't. Number 9 talks about building in victim assistance and victim assistance programs for human trafficking survivors. And number 10 talks about a civil remedy, which is giving trafficking victims the right to sue their trafficker and be like, you trafficked me, I'm suing you. You owe me $1 million. And so there's this idea of suing somebody. So what we did was we looked at all 50 states. So we built this big database that has 10 rows along the top, one for each of the, or 10 columns along the top, one for each of the laws, and 50 rows, one for each of the states. So there's 500 cells in the database. And we went through and we researched what state has each of those 10 laws, and we filled in along the boxes, and then we gave folks credit for the laws, and this is how it all shook out. And so the folks that have 7 to 9 of the laws are green, and then yellow, then orange, then red. And you could see how the states shake out, right? So California is one of the green states. And so there's all this movement that needs to happen at the state level, because just like the dogfighting and cockfighting laws, we don't want to stop until we've filled in all 100 of those boxes, or all 500 of those boxes. It's pretty simple. You just go and go and go. Let me finish in a second, then we'll do questions. So those are some of the laws that are happening. Let me throw out a couple other ideas for laws that aren't reflected in these 10, but other states have tried. So there is a couple states that are talking about taking a look at a woman in prostitution's criminal record. So let's say there's a woman who's in prostitution. And the way that the police really investigate and try to crack down on prostitution is they go after the women. Because the women are the easiest to catch. It's really hard to catch the Johns. And maybe they think that the women are most to blame for it. Like, if she weren't there in prostitution, he wouldn't be trying to buy her. It's her fault for wearing a short skirt, you know, or whatever else, right? It's these ridiculous thoughts. So when a woman's in prostitution, usually she has a pretty long criminal record. So when she's trying to get out of prostitution and trying to get a job, and she say, hey, can I make sandwiches at Potbelly's, or can I, you know, flip burgers at In-N-Out or whatever else, they're like, we don't want to hire you. You've been in jail 50 times for prostitution. And so it tends to be a huge, huge, huge barrier to those women getting back on their feet because of that huge stigma that they have to carry around. So there are some people who are saying, okay, if the person was a victim of trafficking, the entire time they were in the sex trade, they were there against their will. And so all of those times they were being arrested was like arresting a slave. And so why should we punish that person by having this huge long criminal record for stuff that wasn't their fault? And so they're proposing a bill that says, if the person was a sex trafficking survivor, let's make sure that their entire past criminal record gets sealed. And so employers, when they're looking for, you know, this person's looking for a job, the employer won't see all those different prostitution charges. So that's one bill that people are contemplating, and a few states are kind of dabbling with it. Another bill that's really interesting bill is people are taking a look at the minimum age that you can strip in the United States. And interestingly enough, there are a few states where the age is less than 18. So you can be like a 16-year-old stripper, and it's legal. So when you see these things like the Hustler Club, like barely legal, they're actually not kidding. The person's not even legal. But there are other states where the minimum age is 18. So we're saying you can strip, but you can't drink at the bar you just stripped at. And so why do we think that the person can't handle the responsibility of drinking, but they can be naked on a stage in front of a bunch of guys trying to buy them, right? So there are some states that are thinking, let's try to raise the minimum age of exotic dancers to 21. So it comes into line with the drinking laws. Something to be thought about. Some people really agree with that. Some people totally don't agree with that. But that needs to be kind of worked out in the legislative process. A couple other bills that folks are working on. Interesting bill about cracking down on Johns who have sex with kids. So if there's a John, and it's found out that that John is having sex with a child, what is the criminal penalty that that John is facing for having sex with a child? There are some states that don't really even have an enhanced penalty, where it's like, if the John is having sex with any prostitute, here's the crime, here's the fine, here's the jail time. But they're saying, okay, let's put in a new law that if the John is found to have sex with a child, that's basically statutory rape. It's also a form of child abuse. So that penalty for that John having sex with a child should be way higher in terms of time in jail, and that penalty in terms of the fine should be way higher. So states are saying, let's throw the book at the Johns who have sex with kids. And so there's state laws that are being passed that really beef up those penalties. And that's one way to look at it. There's other state laws that are saying, let's not focus on the John actually going through with the act of having sex with the kid. Let's focus on even soliciting the kid for sex. So even just going up to a child and saying, can I have sex with you for $40 is a crime, even if you don't go through with it or not. And it's a law called the sexual solicitation of a minor. And it's agreeing to a sexual transaction for money with someone who you know to be a minor. That becomes a crime in and of itself. So that's an interesting law to take a look at, right? Now, Maryland just passed that law. And so now Maryland, it's a crime to sexually solicit a minor. And so the Maryland police did a really interesting thing. They put a decoy ad up on Craigslist or whatever else that the police created the ad, and they took the picture and they typed up the text, and the police were operating the phone, and they said, young hot girl, come buy sex, you know, whatever else, call this number. And all of a sudden, all these Johns started calling and being like, hey, I want to buy sex, where do I go? And the police were actually talking to the John, and they were saying, okay, let's email back and forth, or let's phone call back and forth. And by the way, we just want to let you know that this girl that you're about to buy is 15 years old. Do you still want to go through with it? And these 15 Johns were like, yes, I do. 15 sounds good to me. And so they agreed to meet at a parking lot, and the police were like, okay, yeah, just meet us at the parking lot. So the John thought that he was talking to a pimp. And then he shows up at the parking lot, and the police are there to meet him, and they're like, put him in handcuffs. And the John's like, what'd I do? I didn't have sex with anybody yet. And they're like, you agreed to have sex with a minor who you knew was 15 and you agreed to the commercial transaction. That in and of itself is a crime. And they were able to lock up 15 Johns that night, one of whom turned out to be the chief of staff of a major congressman on Capitol Hill who was then fired the next day. So there's this chief of staff who was agreeing to have sex with a 15-year-old. So there's these laws. So you could pass one law, which is the commercial sexual abuse of a minor, where you actually go through with the sex, and then you have a beefed-up penalty and fine. Or you could have another law that's sexual solicitation of a minor, where you just solicit the minor for sex. So there's two different laws that you could do to focus on Johns. There's a third law to focus on Johns, which is really interesting. There are some laws, and this is one of these things that so shocking when I learned that this exists. I was like, what? Are you kidding me? There are these laws where if a John has sex with a child, the John has the ability in the court of law to make a defense for themselves by saying, yo, I didn't realize she was a child. I thought she was 18, or I thought she was 19. So you can get away with it by just claiming, I didn't realize she was 16. It's kind of like if you followed the case with Lawrence Taylor, who was the major star football player for in New York for the Giants. Lawrence Taylor had sex with a 16-year-old, and when he got into court, he was like, your honor, she told me she was 19, and so I went through with it, and so don't bust me for having sex with a child. I thought I was having sex with a 19-year-old. And the judge was kind of like, I don't care what you thought, she was 16, and she's a young girl, you know? And so he wound up getting convicted for that and pleading guilty to that. And so there are some states where it's called the age mistake defense, where you can still claim this defense that you didn't know the person was 19. So some good old boys network of legislators were like, well, let's put this protection in case we ever have sex with a kid, we could like get out of it by making sure we claim that she looked old enough, which is just ridiculous. Like, how does that even exist in our society? I don't believe it. So there are some states that are looking to make a law that says claiming you didn't know she was 18 is no longer a defense in court, and you're not allowed to use that as a defense for yourself. And so what'll happen is, for example, that defense does not exist for restaurants selling alcohol to minors. So if you go to a bar and you're drinking or whatever else, and the bar is like, can I see your ID? And the bar winds up pouring a drink for a minor, the bar can't say, well, your honor, we thought that she looked 24, and so we poured her the Long Island iced tea. They get busted either way, which is why the bars are carding you up until you're like age 60, because they don't want to make sure that you might be a minor, right? And so regardless of whatever you think about men buying sex, at least hold this to this standard, where if a guy's about to buy sex, he better be paranoid as all anything that he might be having sex with a minor. So he should be like, can I see your ID? Can I make sure? Can you like tell me your birthday? Like, you know, like were you around in 1980? Like, you know, do you remember John Bon Jovi or whatever else? Like he should be like really, really asking a question to make sure that he never has sex with a kid, because the liability is on him if it turns out it was a kid, right? So there are some states that are beginning to say, well, let's remove that age mistake defense, which is just such a vestige of patriarchy. It's not even funny. So there's a lot of, I hope this gives you a flavor of how many interesting things can be done at the state level. And then when you take that approach of how many columns across how many states, you just say, okay, age mistake defense, let's make sure it's gone in all 50 states. And you just methodically go through and work on it. Or you say, sexual solicitation of a minor, let's make sure it's gone in all 50 states. Or let's make sure it's passed in all 50 states. And so state policy, there's just like this smorgasbord of all this stuff that you could work on, because the sky's the limit. And the state policy is a chance for community members to engage, it's a chance for legislators to engage and put in place new laws, and it's a chance for all of us to kind of get involved in something that we know is going to have a long-term impact. It's way more than just calling the hotline or buying a product that doesn't have slavery in it or whatever else. This is putting in place something that's going to affect thousands of lives for hundreds of years to come. And that's why policy is such an important place to work on. So what I'd like to do is stop there. Hopefully that gives you a sense of federal laws, state laws, the map, the different innovative state laws that are being attempted throughout the field. And we have about 20 minutes left, because we're going to go till 45 minutes. And so I'm going to open it up for questions. I hope folks have lots of questions. Looks like folks already do. And I'll do my best to answer them. But if I'm not able to answer them, I'll be around at the conference all day. So let's dive in. Yes, ma'am. I think, and I don't mean to speak out of term because I'm not sure about how it works, I believe that if it passed at the county level, it probably can be certain county by county, but the preferential way to do it is probably to get it a state law so it passes all counties at once. I think it was Alameda County.
It was Alameda.
It was Alameda. Okay. There's a state bill that first focused on Alameda County. Perfect. That's what it was. It was a state bill that focused only on that one county. So now maybe it's time to do a state bill that focuses on all the counties or whatever else. So I would take a look at that and look into it further. Yes.
I have a question that sort of picks up on that. You said that California has 7 to 9 of the conditions met, mm-hmm. and you just said that number 7 is one that is not. I was curious what the other one, or is that the only one that we haven't met?
I wish I knew that off the top of my head, and if I had the chart that is the chart behind this map, I would know that, which I don't. So I'm sorry that I don't have that at the tip of my tongue. I could get it for you, though. And if you... if you reach out to Polaris's policy department or check it online, you'll be able to see. Yes, sir.
I'm confused. You talked about statutory rape. You know, you could accuse Johns of that. I thought statutory rape was a crime even if you're not paying for it. That's, yeah. So wouldn't it be a crime if you had sex with a minor?
It would. I think the John is committing two crimes at the same time. They're committing statutory rape just by having sex with a minor, even if they were paid or weren't. And then they're committing the crime of purchasing sex for a minor if they were paid. It's a great question. Some do, but far and wide, I would say nowhere near enough. So if you take a look at the sex trade, and I'll walk you all through kind of a conceptual exercise, right? Let's say there's three major actors in the sex trade. There's the person selling sex, which is usually a woman, sometimes a man. There's the person buying sex, which is usually a man, sometimes a woman. And then there's often some sort of pimp who's the third party that exists to meet those two. So there's this triangle that exists, right? And then if you were to chart out of those three parts of the triangle, where does law enforcement spend most of their attention? It tends to be on the people selling sex, a little bit less on the pimps and a little bit less on the Johns. And so there, if you were to trace and tally up all the arrests across the country, there'd be a lot of women in prostitution, not so many pimps, not so many Johns. And I think that is not a thoughtful, useful, practical approach. I think that it creates a huge revolving door. I think that it disproportionately impacts women. I think that it makes a lot of men get off the hook. And it really is arresting women for men's crimes, really. And so I think what needs to happen over time is that whole balance needs to completely change, where law enforcement spends most of their attention cracking down on the Johns and pimps, and if necessary, charging the Johns with statutory rape when they're having sex with children, and then focusing on investing services in those women in terms of trauma therapy and all those other things, and reducing the impact of the criminal justice system on those women. That's just my own personal belief, but I think that that's what's really needed to crack down on the broader sex trade, not all prostitution, not necessarily trafficking, but broader than that, prostitution. And so because of that paradigm that exists, a lot of Johns who are having sex with kids are either totally getting away with it and no one's ever prosecuting them, or they're never being prosecuted for statutory rape, or in even the most bizarre cases, the police are so obsessed with catching the pimp that they'll call up the John and ask him to be a witness against this pimp. So they'll be like, you had sex with this girl, right? And he's like, yes. And they're like, okay, you just admitted having sex with a 14-year-old. So are you willing to testify that this was her pimp? And so the John will be a witness against the pimp, but not in his own case. So I think that our field, our society, our culture has a long way to go in terms of wrapping our brains around the impunity that we've given Johns who feel like they could have sex with kids and just kind of shrug their shoulders and be like, no one's going to care. No one's going to catch me. No one's going to go after me. These are these disposable kids anyway. And so there's this really, in terms of the amount of work that we have to do from a state policy standpoint, if this is, you know, zero, and how far has the field gotten? From a state policy standpoint over the past 8 years, we've gotten pretty far. But from a standpoint of having a discussion about Johns with kids, we're just in the baby steps of really starting to do best practices of statutory rape and all these things. So long way to go there. Orange, yes.
Hi. I was just wondering, how important is it to consider like the Supremacy Clause? Considering the fact that like the federal government's laws are like supreme to the state laws, so like no matter how much legislation the states put forward, how effective is that going to be with regards to like interstate commerce, like trafficking people across state borders? Mm-hmm. So how much power does that have considering the Supremacy Clause if we don't have federal laws protecting it?
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know some of the details, but I do know that just based in certain crimes when the federal law does have jurisdiction, like when there is interstate commerce or when multiple states are impacted, then the Supremacy Clause can kick into gear. But I think that there are still plenty of laws that happen at the state level that even though the federal law says one thing, the state law still governs its own domain. So the federal law has always said that kids who are held in the sex trade are victims of trafficking, and victims of trafficking should not be prosecuted. They should be given services. So that's the federal paradigm. But there are state laws that say this is a child prostitute who we're going to throw in jail. And the state law is able to do that without the federal law trumping it. So I think that the Supremacy Clause kicks into gear in some instances and not in others. But I'm not entirely sure. If there are lawyers in the room, someone please answer for me.
We're baby lawyers. We're responsible. So, it's okay for the state law to be more strict than the federal law. Mm-hmm. As long as there's no conflict in that, the state law just has to be up to the level of the federal law, and it's okay then.
Got it. Wow, yes, way back there.
Hi, I just wanted to know if any of the current legislation was going to be dealing with if the victims themselves did not see themselves as victims. Mm-hmm. I know that a lot of times arrests are made in order to get the children off the street mm-hmm. and into a program, perhaps, mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. just thrown in jail. And I was unsure about, you know, in the sense of the captivity of the mind and the different things the children have to endure mm-hmm. in their development, that if that was addressed at all. I mean, because that could create a whole other problem.
It is. I think it's a great question. And that is a point that's made a lot, is sometimes the people you're talking to don't necessarily see themselves as victims, or they don't know the exact definition of trafficking. They just know that something has felt bad, but they're not able to say, I'm a trafficking victim. I don't know of any laws that would be a standalone law that only talks about that, but I do know that in the definition of a lot of the laws that are created, sometimes the definition says something like, you know, this is a crime, and it doesn't really ask what the victim's state of mind was. Like, it just focuses on that the crime happened. So I think that, to answer your question, I think that it mostly is encompassed in the existing laws, and I don't think there's any specific laws that would just address that on its own, is my sense. Yeah.
Hello, my name is Arthur Tham, and I'm from California Against Slavery. And we're actually working to pass a ballot initiative, in the state of California that would address a number of the shortcomings that even the Polaris Project identified in the law. And the state of California, we're missing a few of these things. Like number four, our ballot initiative would mandate human trafficking training for law enforcement. Mm. We're also missing the safe harbor section, that's number seven. And we're missing number eight, because in the state of California, we do require the proof of force, fraud, and coercion. So our ballot initiative that we're trying to pass in November 2012 would address all these issues, and it would also make the other state laws that are, right now the California state law is lacking in compared to the federal law. We would also upgrade the state laws to make those a little bit more comparable. And we actually have a breakout session at 3 p.m. It's called Going Mainstream with Human Trafficking, and we'll be meeting at the St. James Parish at the church next door. So if you want to learn more about how to make your state laws stronger right here in the state of California, come join us.
Great. Yes, sir.
Thank you. You had mentioned that 44 of the states currently have laws in place. Can you tell me which six do not? I'm a little embarrassed about my home state of Massachusetts being on there. So.
Yeah, Massachusetts... I believe it's Massachusetts, West Virginia, one of the Dakotas, and a handful of others. Yeah, I believe it's Massachusetts, West Virginia, Arkansas, South Dakota, and then there's a few others that I'm not sure of. I think those are the few. You're right, though, that this map kind of obscures that because it doesn't isolate because you could still be red but have a few laws. So there's another map that Polaris has on our website that our policy team created where it's like, it's just a yes or no, where it's like, does your state have any human trafficking legislation, yes or no? And the few that are highlighted on that state will answer your question. So I'm sorry, I don't have it on the tip of my tongue. Yes.
Person who wanted to help the people in Massachusetts, if you get a template, you mm-hmm. could share that with someone who may not know where to start in their legislature to draft the laws.
Great question. Yes, state laws heavily build off each other. And it's this really cool thing that happens in state laws where when one state does something, the other states are like, we're going to use it as a template. And that's what happened with Safe Harbor. That's what I think is going to happen with the supply chains bill. That's going to happen with some of these sexual solicitation of a minor bills. Like once when someone comes up with a good idea, it can just flow in other states. So yes, we do two things in that regard. One, we can highlight templates of certain innovative state laws that passed and send that to other states because we have a repository of all the state laws that have passed. So we could be like, y'all should check out Alabama's new law on criminal record expungement, and we could send that out. The other thing we've done is we created this thing that we call our Comprehensive Model State Law, CMSL, and it's gone through three editions, and it was written by all these lawyers, and it's been heavily reviewed by all these pro bono law firms, and it's this really solid, well legal research document that provides all these model template language on like 30 different legislative provisions. And so it's kind of like a buffet menu where you can download that buffet and be like, I want that, 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 that. And that's kind of a compilation of all the templates in one place. So yes, we definitely do that. Just to let you all know, I have about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to try to go quicker and answer questions in less time. Yes?
I have one question with basically three subparts, and it has to do with what we can do. So the CPCA, I understand, the last thing I heard was it stalled in South Carolina. Is there anything I can do about making them get on board with it? I think I got those emails from IJM.
What are your other subparts?
The other one is, again, what can we do? You're talking about the California supply chain thing turning it into a federal law. And then the third one is encouraging other states to enact anti-trafficking laws. Like I understand, I think Hawaii doesn't have any, but I live in California. Do I have any standing with them?
Great three questions. What I'd say is common things that anyone could do. One, trying to build political will around this issue. And trying to build a constituency that's willing to put some muscle on Capitol Hill. And so if you're involved with calling your representative and saying, I need you to fight for this, or if you're involved with connecting with other folks that you know at the grassroots space and say, we need you to fight for this, that's generally the engine that creates and makes stuff happen. To stay plugged into what's happening in places like Hawaii and other places, Polaris maintains a really detailed grassroots network, which is a network of people who we send legislative alerts to, and you can select which parts of the network you want to be part of. Like, I want to hear about legislation in Hawaii, or I want to hear about legislation in California. So I would encourage you to go to our website, and there's a little Join Us button. Click on Join Us, fill that out, be part of our grassroots network. There's about 15,000 people that are part of it, and we send action alerts that would answer that question in real time. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is David Soliveri. I'm a member of the Alameda County Republican Central Committee. And while as a Christian, I'm very much drawn into the whole anti-slavery crusade, as a fiscal conservative, I'm wondering what all the costs are. You mentioned, I think, $15 million if you add up the CSEC, $2.5 million per times six communities. You didn't put a price tag on the CPCA. I'm wondering how much is the TVPA currently authorized for, and how much has it been appropriated for within the last 8 years? If you could speak a little bit to the costs. Thank you.
Great question. I think for folks who are fiscal conservatives, trafficking is the place to be because we're one of the leanest issue areas with the least federal funding. So the amount of money that we're taking from the federal government budget is minuscule. There are some folks in the trafficking field who compare the war on drugs to the war on trafficking, and they say that the war on trafficking, all the funds that have ever been spent by the federal government on trafficking are the equivalent of 3 days on the war on drugs. So if we're saying trafficking is the fastest growing criminal industry, the amount of money being put into the war on trafficking is minuscule compared to the amount of money being spent on other issues. So you're right, that price tag on the CPCA and the Wyden bill is probably like $12, $15 million. The price tag on all federal trafficking spending, when you add up all the cabinet level agencies, I believe is around $120 million a year to do all of it. But I think that the general 50,000 foot view to be aware of is that when you look at federal spending, there's all these things that are this, 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 and federal spending on trafficking is like this much. And so even if we bumped it up a little bit, it would still be minuscule compared to most of the other issues. So we're looking for those little increases, but I don't think it would really vastly change the federal budgetary situation or whatever else. It's like very, very thin marginal differences. But the bills are mostly quite lean, especially in this environment. Yes.
I know with the CPCA, we were able to go to senators' offices and take with them signature cards and other things like that. Mm-hmm. For the other bills that you mentioned, are there things like that that we can do? Can we go to your website to find that out?
Yes, I would go to the website. For the federal supply chains bill, nothing yet because it hasn't birthed yet. For the TVPA, nothing yet because it hasn't birthed yet. So for the CPCA, there is that engine of postcards and things, so I would focus there. And for this Wyden bill, the domestic sex trafficking bill, there's starting to be postcards and things like that. So I would do what you're still doing on CPCA, and then I would try to get plugged into the network of folks working on the Wyden bill and wait for the other two. Yes.
I have to read this because my brain goes blank with a microphone in my hands, but what was the rationale for not including the prosecution of Johns who go abroad and return stateside as not one of the top 10 statutes at the state level?
That is a great question. I think that for us, it was just a statute that is mostly focused federally, where there's a law called the Protect Act, which focuses, and it basically says, abuse a child in this country, go to jail in your home country. And so it extends extraterritorial jurisdiction over Johns that travel from the U.S. abroad to have sex with kids. Right now, we don't have laws about Johns who travel abroad, have sex with adults, and come back to the U.S. The Protect Acts just focus on children. But typically, and I'm a little bit out of my league on this answer, but typically I think that that tends to be something that the federal government that focuses on, and I don't think there's many state governments that are focusing on Johns traveling as much, so it tends to be only a federal thing, and because it's only a federal thing, we didn't include it in this state thing, this state map. All right, let me do one more question. We're down to 1 minute, and I'm going to try to keep us out right on time because I know this conference is obsessed with being exactly on time. So I will try to do one more question and answer it in 1 minute. Any last person? Yes, ma'am.
I keyed in on number 2, labor trafficking. Do you see a linkage with the use of undocumented workers in our food supply?
Sure. That's a great question. A little bit broader than policy, but definitely a great question. So the question is, when you're looking at labor trafficking situations, where do the victims come from? And the answer is, I think that we see victims in all different states of the legal process. So there are some trafficking victims of labor trafficking who are totally undocumented, and they were smuggled in, they have zero documents, they've never come into contact with the immigration authorities, and the reason that they're being victimized is because the traffickers are taking advantage of their undocumented status and saying, if you ever try to speak up or get away from me, I'll call the authorities on you and get you deported. So they use that undocumented status as a lever of controlling somebody. There are other situations of labor trafficking that we're seeing where the traffickers are actually using victims who are legally in the United States. So they may use some legitimate visa to come into America. There's the J-1 visa, which is the summer work and travel visa. There's tourist visas. There's certain types of guest worker visas where you could come in on the H-2A or H-2B. And so the person is entirely legal in the United States, but the trafficker focuses on victimizing them anyway and using other types of control mechanisms. And then the last thing I'll say is we see some types of visas where the person's visa is only valid as long as they work for this one employer. So there's a visa for diplomats where if a diplomat comes to America and they are able to bring their servants along with them, so they're able to bring their servants in on this type of visa called the A3 or the G5 visa. And the servant has that visa only as long as they work for that one diplomat. And as soon as they say, I quit, I don't like you, and they walk out of the house, they become totally illegal in the United States. And so sometimes the person feels like they're stuck in that work situation, and then the diplomat is able to remind them, may I remind you that you'll be illegal if you ever leave me? And so then that becomes a control mechanism. And so we see it all over the map, undocumented or not, and I'm not sure if we know which one is more. That we're just kind of learning about both cases. Great, well, this is a great session. I think we got through a lot. I hope y'all found it useful. Thanks for coming. And if folks had questions that you wanted to ask that you weren't comfortable asking in front of the big group or whatever else, I'll be around for the next few minutes until I have to run to the next session, which is on demand and people buying sex and what you think about it. Thanks so much.